This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be on fire laws, what you need to know. I am joined by senior barrister and part-time judge Sailesh Mehta from Red Lion Chambers in London. Sailesh prosecutes and defends in high-profile, complex and law-defining cases, and he regularly advises government agencies at a national level. Sailesh heads up the fire and law team in his chambers, and he also lectures other lawyers and judges on aspects of law both in the UK and abroad, and he is a founding member of the Bar Human Rights Committee. Sailesh, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure, Hattie.
When we say fire law, many of us understandably don't get very excited, as it doesn't seem to be, let's say, the sexiest topic to get learning on. However, as well as some quirky facts, there are some serious points in our laws that we should and need to be aware of, so that we can not only keep us and our loved ones safe, but so that we can also be aware when laws are being broken. Following the tragic incident of the Grenfell Tower fire in 2017, many of us have started to think about our fire laws, and discussions in the press and in courtrooms have taken place more now than ever before. With over 174,000 fires in the UK to year ending September 21, and with a typical house fire doubling in size every minute, in this episode, Sailesh and I will bring you interesting and jargon-free conversation on this all-important topic. Sailesh, can we start by talking about what the fire safety legislation there is in place for homeowners, if any, and also what fire safety legislation there is for a landlord renting their home to tenants?
So the starting point is that this is a matter of life and death, literally a matter of life and death, and we've become painfully aware of the importance of fire legislation. Anyone that's listened or read report about what's happening in the Grenfell inquiry would be well aware, firstly, of the legislation surrounding fire law, but also of the problems of the legislation surrounding fire law. So as far as homeowners are concerned, there is, frankly, little or no legislation that requires, in a mandatory way, homeowners to protect themselves or their guests when it comes to fire.
And I find that extraordinary, Sailesh. I have to tell you that. I find it extraordinary.
Particularly in where we have the City of London, which was destroyed by Great Fire historically.
Yes, 10-something, wasn't it?
66, yes. And we might imagine huge rafts of legislation compared to any other country. But in fact, what's known as soft touch or light touch regulation has been the watchword throughout this area over the last 30 years. Subsequent governments have decided to make the touch lighter and lighter. And of course, it's reactive in that the less regulation there is, the greater the risk. And then every time there is a fire, like Lacknell House or like Grenfell, where people die, then suddenly there's alert towards legislation. And so it's done in a piecemeal fashion. So one step forward, two steps back is the norm for this particular area.
Yes, I mean, I read something. One of the reasons why there's no fire safety legislation that covers existing homes, you know, residential homes, that no government would attempt to legislate an Englishman's home is his castle. And I thought, well, that's all great, but you're not actually saying to people, we want you to live in a certain manner in your home and in your private space. What you're saying is, in order to keep you safe, you have to take these steps. I mean, because for landlords, they must carry out, you know, fire risk safety assessments and keep them up to date and have smoke alarms installed in every floor with carbon monoxide alarm in every room and fuel burning appliances like boilers and things. So it is extraordinary how there's fire rules in our laws for landlords, but not if you own that home privately for yourself.
It's that fine balance which the legislators have to grapple with between individual freedom and, of course, other people's freedom not to be overcome by smoke and flames. So while one might say my home is my castle, of course, if there's a fire in your castle, yes, the next door neighbour is going to be affected, yes, by it. Your visitors, your children,
yes,
are going to be
affected. It is tragic. I have read some really tragic stories this year of families dying in fires. And when I sort of looked at the main causes of fires, cooking fires apparently are the main causes of fire in a home. And every 6 days, someone dies in a fire started by smoking materials.
One of the cases I recently prosecuted involved a restaurant that had an open fire. It was a pizza restaurant that also had a chip pan. And above were people that were resident and who were locked in their rooms with no fire alarm. And so you can imagine that the potential hazard that those upstairs who were locked in the room with no means of being warned about a fire downstairs would have faced.
Gosh,
so it is unfortunately commonplace.
And absolutely. And then I read that two accidental house fires were started every day by candles. And I mean, I knew of a family who passed away because of a faulty electric charger for a phone. Faulty electrics cause about apparently 4,000 fires a year in each home. But who is responsible for enforcing fire legislation in the UK? So if you're concerned about the fire safety in your rented home or your workplace or in a public place, who would we go to report our concerns so that they can be investigated?
So there are a number of bodies that are responsible for different parts of fire safety and fire legislation. So that the starting point and the most obvious starting point is, of course, your local fire brigade. And the country, certainly in England and Wales, is split up into regions, and each region has its own fire brigade, a fire safety organisation. And so that would be the starting point. And usually that's the authority that prosecutes for breaches of fire safety. But you also have the local authority that's responsible for some aspects of fire legislation.
That's interesting. I didn't realise the local authority would have their hand in that. That's interesting.
Oh, absolutely. And because fire safety comes under the umbrella of health and safety, of course, the Health and Safety Executive also have some involvement in fire safety. But the key body is really your local fire brigade. They're the ones that will come and advise, that will come and put out a fire, that will prosecute as well if the need arises.
Yes.
And so that's usually your starting point. And of course, as you can imagine, that the fire brigade's main concern is less the individual home, much more the factory, the block of flats, the houses in multiple occupation, and restaurants and so on, the like, where the most number of fires or the greatest risk is attended.
Indeed. I mean, the Health and Safety Executive, we also refer to them as the HSE. I always thought that naturally, before I started reading on this topic, I thought, well, you have to go to a government body somewhere. You don't really start to think as an everyday person as I am, you should go to your local fire brigade and start there and say, look, I'm concerned about the fire safety. It could be, as I said, in your rented home or in your own home. And they do attend, to my knowledge, at no cost to you. They will come out for free to do a fire risk assessment in your home or in your rented home and to advise. And I think not enough people, not only they don't know about that, we don't know about these things, but don't think of taking it up. I think the only interaction I ever had with my local fire brigade was when I was at a school, at primary school, when they visited and they came along with the big fire engine and all the big hoses, pipes. And I remember picking one of them up because we all had sort of lined up and were able to do that, thinking, this is really heavy. And that's why I remember that day. But then we're not taught taught anywhere or you know, reminded anywhere that just gets a fire risk assessment done at the very, very, very least. You know, you don't have to live in a block of flats, do you? I mean, my floor, my house is a normal house, but I've got these sort of ladders that fold up and go under the bed that you can throw out of the first floor. You know, God forbid, should there be a fire and you not be able to get down the stairs. It's quite exactly. Interesting.
Part of my professional life, of course, I meet chief fire officers every now and then, and they have two common themes. When they associate with the public, the first is prevention is better than cure.
Absolutely.
So they all want people to have fire alarms, to have smoke detection alarms, etc. The second theme that always comes across is the lack of money. Every single fire brigade over the last 20 years has had a reduction in the amount of money that local and central government funded with. And therefore, what used to be normal tasks, such as knocking on doors and talking to homeowners about fire safety, are almost non-existent because fire brigades have had so many cutbacks that they've just had to cut back on these sorts of essential.
It's a shame. It's a shame because it is absolutely essential. And something you said at the very beginning of this podcast, you know, it's just not optional. You know, the other, it's not an option to not have fire safety. But while we're discussing the topic of fire regulations, so I have to ask you this. In June 2017, when we saw the terrible tragedy of the Grenfell Tower, in which 72 people lost their lives, to June 2021, a multi-million pound claim was started by more than 800 bereaved survivors and 102 firefighters against 23 defendants and organisations. A public inquiry found that the external cladding used on the Grenfell Tower did not meet building regulations and that there was compelling evidence that the external walls of the building failed to comply with, I think it was requirement B41 or Schedule 1 to the Building Regulations 2010 Act, in that the cladding did not adequately assist or resist the spread of fire having regard to the height, use and position of the building. How can it be that some almost 5 years later, the company that produces cladding and those that were involved in the safety of Grenfell, and I think it was Royden who was the main contractor and the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, who were the landlord of the 24-storey West London Council block, have not yet been brought to account, particularly when the inquiry says, this is why this fire spreads so viciously. What are your views on that, Salish? What's your views on that case?
The findings of Grenfell and the families of the deceased must feel it's an insult upon an injury the longer the time that goes on before they see any form of justice. And so one can well understand that the concerns they have. Can I just briefly outline the major issues?
Yes, please do.
Any progress. So, of course, an inquest has started, but the inquest was started and then adjourned or stopped because we had the Grenfell inquiry. The Grenfell inquiry has been rightly, painstakingly detailed, and the first report after the first phase of the inquiry has already come into print, and there's going to be some legislation as a result of it. And of course, the report was critical of some parts of the London Fire Brigade. It was critical of the local authority. It was critical particularly of the cladding or the firms involved with the cladding. And quite a lot of interesting, revealing evidence has come to light as a result of witnesses from those cladding companies giving evidence. So there are a number of people and individuals as well as companies and corporations that are in the firing line, so to speak, for possible prosecution. As I understand it, the criminal investigation started roughly at the same time as the Grenfell inquiry, and that continues. You'll understand, of course, that this is one of the most complex investigations, given the number of deaths, given the number of people involved. Just looking at the list of witnesses who have given evidence to the Grenfell inquiry gives one an idea of the enormous task that a prosecutor has. But I would not be surprised if in the next few months we hear about some defendants being prosecuted. It'll be a first phase of prosecution. I suspect there'll be at least three or four phases of prosecutions involving different groups of companies and individuals. Yes. So there is likely to be justice, or at least the start of the semblance of justice fairly soon.
You know, I sit here as a layperson and I say, if my initial thoughts on Grenfell, honestly, were that, well, surely at the time this cladding was fitted, it must have been within regulations. And now that what's happened has happened, they've seen that actually it's not, it wasn't the best cladding to use because it caught fire far too quickly, didn't give people a chance and the building a chance. But when I read in the inquiry that the cladding was actually not fit and not within regulations, I thought, well, hold on a moment here. You know, in my mind, this is a slam dunk, surely. But I can appreciate that, you know, they need to unravel it. They need to put it into the boxes within the legal sort of realm, if you like, in order to say, right, well, this is where this comes into and that's where that comes into. And there's lots of people involved. And that's why things are taking a bit more time. But I think I was really pleased to see that something had, some legal recompense has started.
And of course, as you mentioned, the civil case has started, but the chances are those advising the claimants in the civil case will say that if the criminal case is about to get off the ground, then it may be worth waiting.
Yes.
It's cheaper and easier for the civil claimants.
Indeed.
One aspect of inquiry, Hattie, that is not a feature, in fact, of the inquiry, relates to cost. So some would say that for political reasons, when the terms of the inquiry were set, the judge who heads the inquiry was not allowed to examine what had happened to funding over the last 20 years. And some critics say that because of a lack of funding for local authorities, the building regulation department did not check cladding in the way that they could have.
And wow,
that's part of the light touch regulation. And the problem with deregulation of any industry is that those involved then have a race to the bottom. And that's what seems to have happened in relation to all aspects of buildings in this country, that there's a race to the bottom to make things cheaper. And of course, therefore, those at the edges, at the margins, will find an incentive to break the law if it has been broken. And that's some of the story that was uncovered in the inquiry.
Yes, I mean, to be honest, we could do a whole podcast, and I know, and I think we should. In fact, I'm going to write that down. The next one's going to be about Grenfell, because I've got views and points and things that I've read on that. For example, that the Grenfell Tower had no smoke alarms fitted. There was no smoke alarms in that building. And again, I'm going to make a note. Let's do a whole podcast on that, Salish. I think that would be a really interesting chat.
Given that I was at Grenfell with a small group of lawyers.
I remember you saying, yes, that you assisted. You've been assisting on that as well.
And so now I'd welcome such a podcast.
Excellent, excellent. Now let's go on to our last couple of points that we want to discuss today. Smoke alarms have not been mandatory by law in privately owned homes in the UK. However, now Scotland has become the first UK nation to legally require every home to have interlinked smoke alarms. The legislation was introduced in 2019 following the Grenfell disaster, but was delayed until 2022 due to the coronavirus pandemic. Who will this affect, and what will be the new requirements by law for every home, Salish?
So if it comes into law in this country, then of course every householder will have to, by law, have more than one type of smoke alarm, and ideally a smoke alarm on each floor. And if we follow the Scottish model, then it'll be an integrated alarm system. So if one alarm goes off, then the others do as well. So that if you've got a fire in one corner of the house and the alarm goes off, everyone else in the house, in the safe part of the house, would hear, so that you don't have to wait for the fire to spread. So that's the rationale for it. It's a matter of judgment as to how strict the regulation will be. But I should say that the need for smoke alarms already applies in slightly different circumstances. So if you are, for example, a landlord with a house in multiple occupation, or if you are a management company of a large block of flats, or if you're the boss or a company that owns a factory, then of course the legislation on fire alarms and fire detection applies to you, as it always has done. And I suspect that there will be a raft of new legislation that will tighten up the need for fire safety for those that are already subject to the legislation. But as you say, there will hopefully, I mean, it's going through Parliament at the moment for England and Wales. And,
excellent, because I was going to ask that. I was going to say, are you aware that sort of we're looking at it in England and Wales as well, rather than the Scots have obviously front foot forward, and our hats off to them, because as I said to you earlier, I just can't believe that it's not part of our rules and regulations and laws that we should have fire safety, because it is safety. It's not, I really don't see it as an intrusion into how people live. I see it as a necessity, because the option of having a fire is just not optional.
Exactly. And the consultation for that legislation started late last year. And so the hope is that the result of the consultation will turn into a white paper, which will then go through Parliament. So there are a number of stages yet, but I suspect an element of public pressure will force the government to find legislative time in a very busy parliamentary schedule to try to deal with that problem. Of course, the government's already trying to deal with the problem of cladding. You'll be aware that Michael Gove has been appointed as a housing minister, also the levelling up minister. Part of his job, and he's the fourth housing minister, I should say, in a very short period of time. And part of his job will be trying to fix what's known as the cladding scandal at the moment. Because the part of the scandal is, firstly, that the cladding was there in the first place in so many public and private buildings. And secondly, that when it came to light, mainly post-Grenfell, there was a lacuna as to who should pay.
This is it. I've done a podcast actually specifically about this in one of our property podcasts, because there are lots of properties now in buildings, flats, in blocks of flats that are worthless. Because one, they can't get insurance. Two, they can't really sell, because part of the conveyancing question is the bollock and how it's designed and the safety of it. And I have seen, and you may have seen as well, that lots of blocks in lots of different areas have sort of had the scaffolding put up, and you can tell they're being refaced in some format. But you're right. Who does pay? Because service charge becomes astronomical with something that's going to cost at that scale. Should the insurers pay? Should it be the original companies that put this cladding that wasn't actually good enough and wasn't passed in regulations to go up? There's a lot of red tape there, lots of it, you know.
Scandalous, and the figures are difficult to get hold of, but one of the figures I came across was that the average flat owner in one of these sorts of flats will have a bill of about £30,000.
Gosh!
If they were required to pay for it themselves. And so you can imagine the epic battle between the owner of a building and the owner of a flat. And a number of flat owners have declared bankruptcy recently. They did that, unfortunately, shortly before Michael Gove announced that he wants to solve the problem. And the feeling in the industry is that some money will be set aside by Rishi Sunak to try to help flat owners to make sure that it's the government that steps in. Otherwise, of course, this battle will continue into the High Court. And I suspect it's the landlords that may well win the battle, which will, of course, mean that the flat owners will not be able to afford to carry out the repairs.
It is. I mean, it is a legal nightmare, because why should you, as the owner of a property, have to fork out such a big sum of money for something that was not done correctly or properly in the first place? I can see it from both angles. I know you said the landlords might come up trumps, but I can see it from both angles, because homeowners surely need to be protected in this instance. I mean, not many people have got £30,000 lying around, and plus, depending on obviously the height, the width, the breadth of the building, the scale of the job. But I think that the government absolutely has to intervene, and there probably has to be some form of sort of insurance assistance somewhere to sort this out, because I tell you, I would be very nervous living in a block of flats knowing that it still had the cladding that the Grenfell Tower had.
Well, there are some blocks of flats in London as well as outside where the level of danger is seen to be so great that there have to be constant 24-hour marshals.
Oh my goodness.
Until something is sorted out about the cladding and who pays for it and when it can be done.
Well, that's got to be a good thing. That they've taken that kind of approach, because at least there's something in place, to assure that, God forbid, a fire breaks out, everybody can be evacuated quickly and notified quickly. But I think the very first thing that people should be insisting on in any block of flats or any properties is a smoke alarm. Simple smoke alarms. Honestly, I don't want to sound like an advert here, but they do save lives. So, Lesh, that's all we've got time for.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Hattie.
It's always a pleasure talking to you, and I have just reeled you into another podcast, so I'm really pleased about that. Thank you so much for your time and your expertise.
Thank you very much.
What I'll say to our listeners is, don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts, and you can find us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.